sit a second because I'll talk for 20 or 30 minutes, just as a mild, moderate introduction. Hello, everyone. At some point, we may ask you to move up because, as you can see, the sound and video equipment that's normally here is not working. So if you can't hear in the back, we might ask you to come forward. You have no idea who I am, so I'll tell you. My name's Paul Beauvais. I am a distinguished professor. Welcome to the English department. I'm also the editor of the journal Boundary 2, which journal is the primary sponsor today of this lecture by Dr. Anita Starosta. Fortunately, colleagues from Cultural Studies, the European Union Center of Excellence, and the European Studies Center have seen fit to provide additional monies to make possible this visit and the expenses that are incurred. It's a great pleasure for me to have Anita Starosta back on this campus. She's been here three times before, I think. At least three times before. She's also an important colleague on the masthead of said journal, Boundary 2. And fortunately, in the last year or so, has had many very important papers published in the journal. I'll refer simply to two, one called The Future of Criticism. One called Accented Criticism and a collection called The Future of Criticism. And another, which I may mention again in a minute, called Perverse Tongues, Post-Socialist Translations. And I may refer to that because part of her work now going forward has to do with the problem of translation. This is an English department, by the way, which nominally has a concern with questions of translation. As it says on the flyer, which you may have seen anywhere around the campus, Anita Starosta we'll begin from the beginning, took her doctorate at the University of California, Santa Cruz, in the famous program in the history of consciousness, which I've just been told was confused by an ignorant dean with a degree in history, where she studied with, among other people, Vlad Godzich, who last year was a distinguished senior visiting fellow in the Humanities Center. She's been teaching for some time now at the Rhode Island School of Design. She was a postdoctoral fellow at the Pembroke Center at Brown University. And I think starting next year we'll be holding a position at Penn State, our nearer neighbor than Brown. Anita Starosta is the author of the forthcoming book, Form and Instability, Eastern Europe, Literature, Post-Imperial Difference, and that book is about to appear from Northwestern University Press. She's published a series of important articles in major European and U.S. publications, including Angelica, as the aforementioned Boundary 2, Intermedialité. She writes on translation, on problems of aesthetics, and problems of epistemology, normally around or tested around and by confrontations with Eastern European writings. With Vlad Godzich, she co-edited the volume Second Hand Europe, in which she introduced Yuri Andrukhovich. And I recommend that interview to you. Last week when Ben Lerner was here, I passed that interview on to him because Ben was interested in Andrukhovich's work. And he had not seen that interview before. So he read it the first night he was here, talked about it with me the second day. Anita's next project is going to, as I said, consider translation taken as a lens on the contemporary global condition. And like many people at the forefront of her field, is going to confront this as a matter of both visual and print cultures. So she's adding to that already very large range of concerns and references, discussions of problems of human rights, and generally the situation of post-socialist Eastern Europe. So I ask you to welcome Anita Starosta back to Pitt.
being here. I'm really curious who you are, but maybe I could ask that later, because now you're everything you need to know about me. If you can't hear me, please do come up a little closer. Thank you, Paul, so much for the introduction, by the way, and Nancy Condi for helping bring me here and giving me the idea to present on this topic in particular. The title of my talk is Moving Captive Bodies, Unknown Women in the New Europe. And I don't know about you, but when I go to hear talks and people say, you know, start by saying, well, you know, what I have is really not finished and it's kind of all over the place. I'm like, well, so why am I here, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm going to tell you the same thing because this talk just wouldn't end, so I have to just put an end to it. So it's just going to stop at some point. But in the meantime, let me tell you what I have. So, So in a passing anecdote, the Polish writer Andrzej Stasiuk says perhaps the most un-European thing possible. Quote, I'm tired of changes. I would like for the world simply to persist. What interests me is precisely immobility, end quote. And he travels through post-89 Eastern Europe to document and reflect on that immobility wherever he can find it. For Stasiuk, immobility is not a sign of backwardness or so-called path dependency, but a distinctive relation to space and time, to geography and history. His endeavor is un-European because it fails to embrace one of contemporary Europe's defining values, unfettered mobility of commodities, people, and ideas. I am also interested in immobility, in forms of immobility, fixity, or even captivity that can be found amidst all the free movement. In my talk today, the figure of this immobility is the Eastern European woman trafficked for sex work in Western Europe, as she is found in fictions, documentaries, and activist accounts. And I will argue that representations of so-called sexual slavery in post-89 Europe are one of the sites where Eastern Europe's accession to Europe and integration into Europe has been negotiated, perhaps far away from public debates on the topic or international treaties. This is kind of a departure from my work in that it deals with a so-called real-world problem rather than literary texts, and that carries a little bit of risk, but I'll talk about that risk later. The reason I turned to trafficking, or one of the reasons I turned to trafficking, is because it puts into question the common sense assumption that Eastern Europe is a region that has been distinct from and backward with respect to the West, that this Eastern Europe will eventually disappear or become diminished through institutional and cultural integration with the European Union. On the other side of this, and against this common assumption, the commodification and also flexible racialization of Eastern European women's bodies through trafficking contradicts narratives of progressive European integration. It actually renders the region newly coherent by reinscribing it through new demarcations of difference. In light of this, I'm going to consider the poetics of borders and bodies, which doesn't, even though it might sound like it, doesn't detract from their seriousness and their empirical existence. This is because the bodies of strangers, migrants, and sex workers, along with the borders they must cross in order to become what they are, these are always already figures or devices. They're sites of figuration or troping or turning meanings from a straightforward path into something more than it appears. They are sites of fantasy and derealization. Their empirical existence is not opposed to this figurative or poetic dimension. Their representations are possessed of a rhetorical quality that is called literalness. So, part of what I'm interested in is the way in which literalness is actually figurative in general, but in these representations especially, and how that functions in human rights discourse. If mobility is a defining feature of Europe, then the unsanctioned migrant worker, and the female sex worker in particular, operates in public discourse in the liminal space. This figure is explicitly or implicitly understood as an aberration on several registers. On the economic register, as a result of extreme poverty, on the legal register. It's an effect of inadequate frameworks, definitions, enforcement mechanisms, so a kind of failure in the system. An ethical aberration as evidence of unthinkable cruelty and depravity. A historical aberration as an anachronistic reappearance of slavery, a problem consigned to the past. And finally, a racial aberration as an echo of white slavery, in quotation marks, which derived its moral force from the apparent contradiction inherent in the terms white and slavery. As such an aberration, the predicament of the trafficked woman cannot be represented except as a departure from European norms, which are themselves framed in terms of cosmopolitanism, human rights, self-possession, and openness to others. Europe as an idea and as a kind of figure that keeps appearing in public debates about its meaning, about its definition, has been for a really long time defined as an entity that's capable of self-critique and that is uniquely positioned to be open to others. And so it is these values and the others I mentioned that I think are troubled by the way in which trafficking is kind of hyper-visible and invisible at the same time. This kind of framing or figuration of the problem as an aberration, as an exception to norms, ensures that the problem remains external. Even when it confronts Europe directly and takes place in Europe, it is not of it. Films and narratives about sex trafficking are full of images of wounded women's bodies, including, or even predominantly, bodies from the East. This proliferation of images has been celebrated for interrupting dominant conceptions of European identity because they depict the otherwise invisible experiences. As Josefa Leszczycki writes in her 2010 book on new migrant cinema in Europe, for example, such films present, she says, and I quote, a form of otherness that poses cultural and political challenges to the hegemony and homogeneity claimed by the nation state and by extension by the EU itself, end quote. But I think such a celebration doesn't erase the distance between the observer, presumably the proper European subject, and the observed, the stranger, or the underlying conception of Europe as an entity with a center and with peripheries. That remains intact as well. In this context, victims of trafficking can only be objects of dread or sympathy, relations that might shorten the distance between the European citizen and the stranger, but that nevertheless maintain, perhaps even reinforce, the boundary between them. Is it possible, I have been asking myself kind of on and off, because this project is really old and new in a lot of ways, in any case, is it possible to see these figures otherwise? More precisely, can they be made permanently visible, integrated into the very idea of Europe? I'm thinking of a conceptual and rhetorical integration that would entail the confrontation of ideals with realities they cannot admit. A Europe defined by mobility and inclusion on the one hand, and a Europe marked by captivity and exclusion on the other hand. I'm thinking of contemporary Europe as an entity that in fact contains these irreconcilable elements and asking whether they might be made to fit a single account. This would entail thinking about migrant sex work and reproductive labor more generally. By reproductive labor, I mean, and other scholars mean, all kinds of care work, you know, from elderly care to, what else? house cleaning, all kinds of things traditionally performed by women and gendered that way, right? So sex work is not the only thing here. In any case, this kind of integration, conceptual integration or reconstitution of the idea of Europe might entail thinking about migrant sex work as constitutive of Europe rather than as a temporary evasion of or exception from its norms. And this, in turn, I think, requires that we examine the conditions of visibility and legibility of trafficking itself, by which I mean to examine the efficacy of images and narratives that testify to so-called modern-day slavery. To put it differently, to think about trafficking as central to European integration, I think we must ask whether it's possible to effect an opening or a crisis in dominant ways of imagining Europe. And in order to do that, we want to ask what kind of disturbance representations of trafficking are capable of effecting. And it's this kind of disturbance that most of the paper is asking about. For those of you who are familiar with Roland Barthes' Camera Lucida, a beautiful book if you haven't read it, he talks about photographs and talks about, you know, the possibility that some photographs might, you know, of violent events like in the news might be able to shock us, you know, literally shock us by literally representing something horrible, even traumatize us a little bit, but not actually disturb us. He says the photograph can shout, but not wound. So a difference between something being shocking and something being disturbing, these two terms are kind of central to what follows. If, I hope that makes sense. So I'm going to start by talking about representations of trafficking in general, and then a little bit about Eastern European women's condition within those in particular. For background, the figure of the modern-day slave, especially of a sex slave, is said to represent a crime of global proportions, with as many as 27 million people living in slavery-like conditions worldwide, among them hundreds of thousands of women and girls trafficked across borders and tricked or coerced into prostitution. This figure has prompted legal initiatives, such as the U.S. Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act, or TVPA, and the UN Palermo Protocol. Both of these were passed in the year 2000. The human rights concern with the issue is not contained to NGOs, such as Anti-Slavery International or Human Rights Watch, or to newer organizations, such as Free the Slaves. It spills over into faith-based campus movements, I don't know if you have one here, conservative Christian organizations, family values organizations like the Family Research Council, domestic and international legal initiatives, and art projects, such as one called Journey, a traveling installation by the actress Emma Thompson that started in 2008 or 2007, that featured transport containers, like literally huge shipping containers, painted with, you know, typical or recognizable scenes of a migrant woman's ordeal in forced prostitution and, you know, complete with chains and complete abjection. And I'm going to talk about that a little later, actually, in more detail, but alongside things like Thompson's project, there are journalistic accounts, and I'm just going to mention titles because I think they're revealing. Victor Malarek's The Natashas, Inside the New Global Sex Trade, because the Natashas are, as a collective kind of nickname given to Eastern European women who work in the sex trade, whether and they're presumed to be Russian, even though they are from all kinds of places within the former Soviet sphere. Another book was Nicholas Kristof's and Cheryl Wadoon's Half the Sky, with a really interesting subtitle, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide. And lots of films produced in the past two decades. These, of all kinds, like amateur, government-produced feature films, what's that movie? Taken? Have you seen it? Yeah. So all of these projects or presentations, they supplement the dominant anti-trafficking discourse in the attempt to raise awareness and mobilize sentiment. In stories of deception, captivity, and sexual exploitation that end in eventual rescue, escape, or death, it's violated innocence and betrayed hope, and these are usually capitalized, innocence and hope, and sometimes redeemed dignity, that are the heroines as much as or more than their human characters. So these narratives, the reason I that they interested me was because they seemed kind of impossibly emphatic, like really heavy-handed and sensational, and that's something I'm not the only person to notice that. And so I wanted to think about how the figure of the sex slave, such as it is, kind of anchors the anti-trafficking discourse, and the way in which it's rooted in the visual register. Even though it doesn't remain in the visual and kind of goes around and shuttles between visual and verbal registers to make concrete a problem that is said to strain both language and the imagination. The figure of a sex slave circulates most obviously in visual media, but this image of a bound woman or victimized child, which another image, that of a broken survivor, presupposes and contains, also seems to float without any visible means of support. It has a phantasmatic or spectral appearance. It is what can be lifted off the picture, transferred to another medium, translated into verbal expressions. These last couple of lines were from Timothy Mitchell's kind of definition of image, which is kind of really imprecise, because it doesn't need to be an actual photographic or cinematic image. It is something, as he says, that can be lifted off the picture and travel and be transcribed into words, right? So it's really a figure that is visualizable and depends on the visual, but doesn't only concern visual images, if that makes sense. I say all this because this is how I'm talking about images as figures, rather than actual pictures, necessarily. So this appeal to the visual in anti-trafficking campaigns is not exceptional. It's not like this is the only area of human rights activism that depends on it. This follows a long tradition of human rights and visual images being intertwined, of advocacy relying on visuality for proof and persuasion. As the scholar Sharon Slivinsky argues, there will be no human rights without the circulation of visual representations. I'm just trying to see if I can skip it, but no. From its double origins in 18th century campaigns to abolish slavery and the shock of the Lisbon earthquake of 1755, she writes, and I quote, "The history of distant spectators' responses to visual images has had a profound effect on the very constitution of these rights, making images something other than mere, only just illustrations," right? Importantly for me, the appeal to the visual and anti-trafficking discourse also serves to support the claim of literalness, to lend credence to the insistence that this is not a metaphor, this is literal slavery. This is a quote from, it's a voiceover in a film called Cargo, Innocence Lost, that is really something else. It's dramatic, to say the least, but this is not a metaphor, this is literal slavery, is repeated one way or another through the discourse on trafficking. With all this said, I'm just skipping around a little bit. With all this said, any image of a sex slave will be a composite, a condensed reconstruction, a metaphor that insists to be believed. One example might be Birdcage, which is it has a title, it's a little short film, but it's really a public service announcement produced by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. And there's a young girl who appears at first to be sitting on a swing. She turns out to be held captive in a birdcage. She's ordered to sing and smile like a flirt, by an evil man whose hand grabs her face and makes her smile. This kind of image functions in turn as the reference point, actually, for political debates and enforcement practices. As a member of Congress said during debates over the passage of the TVPA, quote, "Victims are found behind dark padlocked doors and hidden corridors. The deprivations of food, the beating with electrical wires, metal rods, and leather straps, the cigarette burns, and the brutal..." Maybe I should stop reading this. "And the brutal rapes are conducted in the hidden rooms and upper floors, where if you can If you can get to them, you can find women and children locked in little cages. End of quote. This image can also dictate law enforcement practice. Victims are often not believed, not certified as victims, and not granted protection under the TVPA unless they conform to the image of a sex slave who might in fact be found chained to a bed in a brothel. Judging merely by the coincidence of, you know, the proliferation of these kinds of representations on the one hand and the legislative, political, and activist initiatives on the other hand, so that it seems like there's been so much activity both legally and discursively, if you will, or in cultural production. It would seem that this figure, with its alarming aspect of a captive woman or an adolescent girl in pigtails who's about to share the same fate, seem exceptionally successful. The evident power of this image challenges the idea that has become kind of widespread among people who think about human rights and their relation to visual images, the idea that, as Susan Sontag has put it, quote, in a world saturated, no, hyper-saturated with images, those that should matter have a diminishing effect. We become callous, end quote. According to this widespread idea, images fail because we become incapable of being moved by them. Or worse yet, as Sontag goes on, quote, citizens of modernity, consumers of violence, adepts at proximity without risk, we are schooled to be cynical about the possibility of sincerity. The feeling persists that the appetite for such images is a vulgar or low appetite, end quote. Yet images of sexual slavery seem to escape this. They continue to be reproduced and invoked and believed. The figure of the sex slave troubles the conventional wisdom regarding compassion fatigue or numbing through overexposure. It moves to action and coheres collectivities. The efficacy of this image affirms the link between sentiment, awareness, and action that is said to be broken within human rights advocacy. This is what all images testifying to atrocity and depravity want, to incite sentiment powerful enough to be believed, taken at their word. And yet the more this figure insists to be believed, and the more successful it is, the more this image is also said to subtend a vast field of misrepresentation. So the more of a hearing it gets, the more it's criticized. The moral outrage at modern-day slavery has been a target of critique that takes awareness and sentiment to be profoundly at odds. The critical project of circumventing or seeing through the dominant abolitionist discourse has entailed resisting the lure of false images and their effective pull. As if only then might the dominant discourse of sex trafficking be seen for what it tries to forget, the more ordinary, much more widespread, and often unofficially sanctioned problems of migration and exploitation in a variety of industries, the complex of factors that make migrants vulnerable to slavery-like conditions in the first place, as well as the patterns of complicity that extend far beyond the individuals involved in human trafficking networks. These analyses have labored to restore the connections and contexts that are severed by the dominant discourse and the image of the sex slave. For Kamala Kempadu, for example, the public concern with trafficking as a crime, rife, as she puts it, with sensationalist reports, hyperbole, and conceptual confusions, signals, quote, a growing panic at the turn of the century by the international political community and national governments about unregulated migration flows and profitable cross-border activities that lie outside the state control. In another instance, Elizabeth Bernstein, who's an anthropologist and sociologist, has argued that the political sensibility informing the current anti-trafficking consensus partakes of a, quote, neoliberalism that locates all social harm outside of the institutions of corporate capitalism and the state apparatus, end quote, focusing instead on individual perpetrators and vulnerable women. This abolitionist rhetoric has also been convincingly compared to the rhetoric of the white slavery scare from the turn of the previous century in its scapegoating of immigrant and migrant men who turn out to be evil or swinish, as Victor Malarek puts it over and over again. In its deflection of collective anxieties over social and economic transformations onto women's sexuality and exercise of autonomy, and its construction of the perfectly innocent victim. And this perfectly innocent victim is ideally, as it happens, Eastern European and blonde and white. The untroubled reappearance of the same tropes and agendas now, a century later, is taken as evidence of an enduring misprision of the real scope of the violence, albeit of a less spectacular kind, attending pro-women's migration. From this perspective, affect only interferes with adequate apprehension. It's also dangerous, invalidating and obscuring forms of epistemic violence that in turn have material effects. The image reproduces racial and gender hierarchies, discursively embedded into notions of agency, victimhood, and sexuality, while the legal mechanisms it authorizes compel the inscription of presumed victims into a narrow frame that, while claiming to restore or even grant them freedom, ends up reinforcing those very hierarchies that seem to take it away to begin with, right? Next part, this is almost over, right? Well, not the problem. The problem is far from solved. I'm sorry. I don't mean to make light. It's just it's when I teach human rights topics, those are the classes where we end up laughing a lot because there's just so much violence that we deal with, you know. But the next thing I want to talk about is witnessing and something that I'm calling a poetics of witnessing, and I'll tell you what that means in a second. A traditional notion of witnessing relies on a certain affective disablement. And the connection to what I just said before is that it would seem like the efficacy or the success of the figure of a sex slave actually enables proper witnessing, right? Because it is affectively disabling, it's shocking, it's depressing. As Shoshana Feldman has argued in her classic essay called Education in Crisis, a disablement is necessary, a kind of crisis is necessary for passive spectators to be transformed into witnesses. If this is true, I think, then a different notion of witnessing may be required in this case, where the expected, appropriate, and culturally prescribed affective response only heightens the risk of complicity. Another kind of crisis will be at work here, one provoked when the sex slave, so-called, is taken primarily as a figure, rather than a well-intentioned, if always partially failed, representation. Attending to figuration instead of the failures of mimesis and misrecognition confronts us with the political and ethical consequences of the fraught relationship between hermeneutics and poetics. And for those of you who know Paul de Man's work, the literary theorists, Paul de Man's work, this distinction between hermeneutics and poetics is, I think,
fabulous.
Yes. let me just tell you what it is. He says, when you do hermeneutics, you're concerned with the meaning of the work, right? So overall, when we keep asking what does the work mean, that's hermeneutics. When you do poetics, he says, you're concerned with the stylistics or with the description of the way the work means, meaning you have to pay attention of how it does its work and how we might get to something like a meaning. These two are actually, for Paul de Man, not complementary, but may even be mutually exclusive, so that one interferes with the other, because the details of the way something is styled, or the way it's made or said or presented, contradict or undo a single, a single interpretation, right? As he says, the materiality of a letter can disrupt the ostensibly stable meaning of a sentence. This is a little obscure, I think. But I'm translating this into the context that I'm talking about to say that the materiality of the image can disrupt its intended or seemingly obvious message. If trauma, as some scholars have said, implies a shattering of a culture's meaning-making scheme and representational modes. So, in other words, if adequate witnessing to a historical collective trauma or political violence or collective violence means that something within a culture's, fundamental assumptions must change, then any crisis that might be occasioned by the image of the sex slave must be measured not in the heightened affect it provokes, but rather in the unmaking of the epistemological foundations that make the image intelligible in the first place and that make it so compelling. A poetics of witnessing is a way of thinking disturbance without shock, which is a reference back to what I told you about Roland Barthes. Before I go on to say more about this idea of the poetics of witnessing rather than the hermeneutics of witnessing, I want to say that perhaps the image of the sex slave is so excessive and emphatic, so I'm trying to empathize with the image right now, because it must accomplish a great rhetorical feat. Human trafficking takes place nowhere and everywhere at once, through clandestine circuitous routes, both in plain view and in sealed vehicles and hidden spaces. It happens behind closed doors, off-screen, to 27 million people bound by inflated debts and invented threats who pass from one kind of disposability to another. In order to succeed, then, this image must turn something indeterminate, not wholly verifiable and invisible, into something intelligible. It must also turn indifference and contempt into compassion, remove the stigma of poverty and undignified labor in order to render disposable people human. It must purify the threatening, unwanted migrant whose mundane labor is both structurally necessary and disavowed, and convert him or her into someone deserving sympathy. By making a diffuse problem nameable and by turning the extended everyday temporality proper to the violation of social and economic rights into the punctual, delimited temporality of political and civil rights, the image makes it thinkable and unthinkable in one and the same gesture. This work of turning, and here I'm going back to the idea of rhetoric, this work of turning is the first sign of the tropological or rhetorical aspect of the image of the sex slave. It entails not merely the work of documenting and exposing something already there, but also figuring it and translating, because by itself it doesn't speak necessarily. In considering the rhetoricity of the image of the sex slave, two divergent meanings of rhetoric must be seen to be in play, and it's in the tension or the gap between these two meanings that something interesting happens. I'm going to skip that. So in one sense of the word rhetoric, in the more familiar sense, it mobilizes a kind of repertoire of familiar images that speak through an ideologically cohesive grammar that makes some things visible, sayable, admissible, intelligible, right? That makes things make sense. And that makes other things inconceivable, impossible. In this first sense of rhetoric, tropes serve the end of persuasion. From this perspective, the power of the figure of a sex slave would derive, as Wendy Hesford, who's another scholar of visual culture, human rights. As she writes, the power of the figure of the sex slave would derive, as Hesford writes, quote, not from individual images, iconic or otherwise, but from social and rhetorical processes of incorporation and recognition mediated by visual representation and the ocular epistemology that underwrites the discourse of human rights. By this she means, I think, that the power of these images is not necessarily because they are themselves so persuasive in themselves, but that it's the kinds of understandings and common sense that they mobilize that are instantly recognizable in them, right? That makes them so effective. So the image succeeds when it affirms the already known, if not always explicitly avowed, values and modes of seeing. The work of figuring and translating into a dominant idiom already puts reference into question, meaning it makes us question whether there's a really there's a real thing being represented or whether it's invented. The separation between the represented object, the reality of it, and the image, on the other hand, has recently been noted in various critiques of anti-trafficking discourse. Images and narratives of sexual slavery operate autonomously from the reality they purport to represent, and this fact doesn't diminish but seems to strengthen their hold. As one scholar observes, journalistic exposés and activist accounts are often shaped through what she calls the rhetoric of revelation. It's only a rhetoric of revelation because it depends on a journalist going into a situation, discovering things as if he or she were a detective, but really, and producing a revelation of a great crime. But really, the journalist is already coming with expectations of seeing, the woman bound to a bed in the brothel, basically, right? Another scholar has said that statistics used in anti-trafficking policy making, not just human rights campaigns, but policy making, are very persuasive, even though nobody can really verify them. So regardless of the lack of reliable data, numbers continue to be cited as concrete proof and invoked as basis for action. There's also something another scholar has called an aesthetic of trafficking in films that try to raise awareness about it, which kind of provides, this aesthetic of trafficking provides the missing proof that is really difficult to find otherwise. And the excessive affect as kind of a substitute for that proof. The circulation of kind of images and figures and rhetorical tropes is a kind of autonomous system, right? Aside from the so-called real world. In Gayatri Spivak's words, this may be a case of there being only, as she says, circle after circle, ellipses, parabolas, asymptotes, this last giving a model of reason always operating by approximation and never access to a singularity. In other words, language can only go so far in apprehending reality. With this in mind, the rhetoric of revelation, the elusiveness of numbers, and the aesthetic of trafficking may be so many unacknowledged asymptotes, only tending toward and necessarily failing to apprehend the referent. The importance of visual images as props becomes clearer. They promise to close the gap by masquerading as direct presentations. But thinking about the rhetorical dimension of language, but also images, is also the opposite, that does something opposite to persuasion. It means, it entails a kind of undoing of understanding, which goes along with the disturbance I was thinking about earlier. The consequences of this might go beyond the observation that a representation and the object represented never fully coincide. This is the lesson that Spivak herself takes from her teacher, Paul de Man, when she says that, quote, to read the social text, taking the risk of the imperative to reference as such, tracing the production of historical referentiality may be bolder than we might imagine, end quote. It is one thing, she means to say, to examine the work of figuration in a text that presents itself as fiction. It's quite another to do the same thing in a text that insists on its own veracity, that is invested in nothing so much as establishing its own referentiality and literalness. Just wondering how much more I want to. Are you just a few pages? Is that okay?
Awesome.
Okay. So taking Spivak's phrase, tracing the production of historical referentiality in the social text of trafficking campaigns, and taking the risk of the imperative to reference, I think it calls attention to the literal as something that is unstable. The rhetorical dimension of these images and of the kind of ekphrastic discourse or verbal discourse based on images that they subtend is not located simply in the figurative means they employ in the service of persuasion. It resides in the very interplay between what presents itself as figurative and what presents itself as literal. I really want to share with you what I have to say about the journey and trying to get there a little more quickly, but okay. The point made by what I just said was that it's really difficult to tell when you're looking at these images especially, what in them is meant to be literal and what figurative, right? Because there's all this work of really invention and embellishment and persuasion that then, that's meant to be persuasive and really impactful, but then undermines itself, right? So I want to briefly look at the production of literalness in a specific instance of visualizing sexual slavery, Emma Thompson's journey that I mentioned earlier, which was a traveling multimedia art installation that featured 7 shipping containers representing scenes of a trafficked woman's ordeal. Shipping containers because people are often smuggled or trafficked in shipping containers, right? Informed by a very sincere desire to raise awareness, the project is also invested in figuring unwanted migrants as human. As Thompson explained in a commentary on the project, quote, Londoners are already uncomfortable in their own city because they are uncomfortable with the number of strangers and the strange languages they hear. We are showing them the reality of the lives of some of these women who are sold into slavery and tortured, end quote. She aims to make invisible crimes not only visible, but also tangible, audible, affecting, so that, as she says, quote, it really hits people deep down. Between 2007 and 2010, the containers intrude into major public spaces in London, Vienna, Madrid, New York, and The Hague, with murals depicting chained women on the exterior and with interiors that allow visitors to walk through the life journey of a trafficked woman stage by stage, from a young girl's aspirations to their brutal betrayal to eventual redemption or resurrection, as the last container is called. Each container, designed by a different artist, engages the audience differently. Through a peephole, the first stages show figurines of women being tricked into going abroad, and then photographs of sex workers posing in revealing clothing that become their uniform. The bedroom, a container of its own, shows the workplace that is also a prison cell, complete with stained sheets on a vibrating bed, prices for services written in lipstick on the mirror, used condoms on the floor, and "help me" written somewhere on the wall. And, as Thompson says herself, it smells really, really bad. Visitors exit the bedroom through a curtain of condoms hanging from the door frame. It's really astonishing. As it moves into the tactile ambient and oral registers, engaging not only vision but other senses as well, the journey puts the production of historical referentiality on full display. It is obviously staging, but only the better to engage multiple senses. Like Doubting Thomas, the spectator witness gets to touch the wound, and the desire to know finds gratification through sentiment. Revulsion, fear, voyeuristic pleasure, pity, horror, shock. Here we may also wonder at the sheer artifice that the staging of literalness involves, but this wonder is not one of the anticipated affects. The spectacle is tawdry and repugnant, presumably just like the reality lived by Elena, the Moldovan woman on whose testimony the project is based. Every detail is claimed to issue directly from that testimony. Thompson, in talking about it, is visibly moved as she recounts the process of designing the journey. As if Elena were a traumatized child, she had given her 7 matchboxes to represent stages of her ordeal, to make the invisible concrete as part of the therapeutic process, as she puts it. Even as Elena's voice is claimed as the primary ground or source of the visual, spatial, and tactile metaphors of the journey, it's also produced by these metaphors, enabling the victim to articulate her experience in the first place. I'm moving towards a conclusion, which isn't a conclusion, but I think that attending to the rhetoricity of the image is not the same as exposing either intentional manipulations or the more or less conscious ideological agendas. The problems it poses cannot be resolved as a matter of false representation or an imperfect imitation, but must come to be conceived as this articulation or an undoing. A poetics of witnessing, this articulates human rights from affect. It detaches human rights from affect and acknowledges the unanticipated and uncontrollable crisis within its own representational modes. The instability of the figure of the sex slave condenses multiple temporalities and orders of meaning-making and intelligibility, such as archaic forms of racialization and sexualization, the liberal regime of recognition that works through humanization, and the neoliberal regime of already accomplished inclusion of workers through their dehumanization. It's not only a matter, and this is the brief return to in connection with the question of Europe, it's not only a matter of Eastern Europe's own ontological, political, and economic instability. It's a site of transition, negotiation, and fixing in place of the core of Europe itself, which is already dislodged from within because it is intimately sustained by a racialized and gendered international division of labor. And it goes on. But this is where I meant to end, and really appreciate your attention and the chance to share it with you. Thank you.
Questions or comments?
Comments, maybe? Yes.
This probably won't lead to a question, but it's an attempt to engage you in conversation about some, a couple of things that were going through my mind as you were talking. One of which is this, that in company with this distinction between the hermeneutic and the poetic, the difficulty that we might have to attend to an image that is clearly, let's say, ornamented or ornamental, in addition to delivering us a message that, that also cries out for attention, right? That split that we might experience. One of the things that occurred to me is, given our own ambivalent relationship to Russia and Eastern Europe, I guess they're white, but they're not like us. You know what I mean? Are they white? Are they not white? Well, they're white. But they're other in some bizarre way that we can never get a real handle on. And therefore, it seems to me that images of exploitation, torture, slavery, and so forth, might have a very different status when it is, let us say, young African children on whom is projected a kind of disingenuousness or a kind of naturalness or a kind of incapacity to ornament themselves. And so therefore, one reads that image in a totally racialized way, different than one would read an image of a blonde, white, Moldovan woman who clearly has not only the capacity, but some people would argue the responsibility to ornament herself. For any variety of reasons. And therefore, we come to go that latter image, I think, with an attitude perhaps of skepticism or of anticipation of her guile. You know, we don't believe Russians, and I'm putting it in a kind of shorthand. They are sneaky. They mix stuff up all the time. They lie to us. They misrepresent things. And therefore, images of them put us in a quandary in terms of the extent to which we take it at face value. I'm wondering if that's part of the kind of thing at play in there.
What's the last thing you said?
If that racialized difference between, let's say, looking at a, you know, Southern African black kid and versus looking at a sex slave blonde female Moldovan, that we bring a profoundly different set of expectations to those two images, regardless of how ornamented the images are, in terms of our expectations of each.
I think, I'm not sure. I think the sincerity of the image of the African child, which is also a kind of figure, right?
The alleged sincerity.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a child. right. So I think that is actually a rhetorical, or I keep saying the word, sorry. It's unavoidable, but it's also a way in, sincerity is part of the way that the images of trafficked women are a figure, right?
Yeah.
So part of their work.
It's frailty. Sincerity as a commodity doesn't work as well if it's a blonde, Moldovan woman. We don't believe her.
What I'm saying is that the images themselves do count on us believing her, and perhaps the hyperbole of the image, right, is meant to counteract any disbelief or skepticism, but I'm saying that we do believe her, judging by just how many of these films exist, and how almost uniformly, in most of them, these women are portrayed as innocent and you know, tricked and violated, and but so the makers of these images count on sincerity to be readable in them.
Despite, I would argue, a real resistance on the part of the U.S. reader. I think that we have our own, whether it's a residual of anti-communism or a dislike of suspicion about the East, by the East I mean the so-called But I think we tend not to believe them.
Well, yeah, I think that we could say that it's possible to disbelieve them based on what you're saying and those ways of relating, right, to Russia as an idea and place and history. But judging by the kind of amount of activism generated by this, people do believe it, you know?
United States people that are appealed to donate money and so forth. Yeah, I'm not signing on to disbelief. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about disbelief as a discursive category that is grounded in anti-communism and the anti-communist past. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Can I actually ask you to fold some of these questions into, I mean, the problem of, let's say, Eastern Europe is a zone of gradation. I mean, a lot of these countries are Europe now, right? They've got a good solid decade of EU membership. And this goes to the question of disbelief because there is the kind of, as you've very clearly laid out, right, the narrative of having been trafficked can be instrumentalized to basically seek asylum, for example. And if one is already European, the set of questions and problems is very different. And this is a little bit of how you frame your talk that actually becomes a conversation about the failures of European integration and about what this kind of process of making Europe Europe is looking like, or not succeeding to look like. And I think that plays with disbelief, the idea of what would be the motivation to lie this way. So let's say Russianness, right, Russians can be believed, but also the idea of what you would be getting in for that lie, or for telling the story at all, seems quite important.
What's the payoff?
And what's then the, I mean, this is the other side of the, what's the problem that these trafficked narratives bring up about Europe. But if you could talk a little bit more about the sort of people who've been trafficked who are within, let's say, the number of the European Union versus not, and how that plays out in these narratives.
Well, first of all, I think that this belief that is showered onto, right? People who might be applying for asylum or claiming victim status under one of these two, you know, legal mechanisms. This disbelief is very real, actually, and the process of getting asylum or getting any kind of protection is arduous and not successful for most people, actually. So even though there's all this hoopla around the TPPA in the US, as a matter of national security also, actually, very few people actually manage to get, you know, permits to remain in the US as a matter of protection for themselves. So it's not, what I'm saying is it's not specific to Eastern European women. It's all sex workers who are always disbelieved. Right, because their job is to dissimulate. It's to be, you know, to receive the fantasies projected on them and reflect them back. Some of these, and this kind of goes to your question, some of these fantasies include Eastern Europe's regional difference, actually, right, which is its relative backwardness and or attributed backwardness, which translates into Eastern European women being perceived as, you know, more pliable, more traditional, less feminist, even though that isn't necessarily at all reflective of the very communist past, right, that you bring up. It is the image and their value, their differential value compared to other kinds of women from other places, depends on this weird combination of their whiteness and their not quite emancipatedness, right? So their ideal. But the Eastern Europe is a zone of gradation. I really love that phrase because the way it figures into narratives of trafficking is that some countries that do, become full members of the EU, stop being sending countries, or at least not don't do it to the same degree. They may even become receiving countries, and then so that the status of a sending country actually coincides with the stigma of Eastern Europe, right? So that those countries that are no longer sending sex workers out into Western Europe or elsewhere are now, have integrated into Europe and are Western, have passed out of Eastern Europe as the zone of gradation, right? Shed the label. And those that are marked as zones of export are almost by definition, by that fact, by virtue of that, continue to be kind of stuck in it. And I keep talking about it as a negative thing, which I don't necessarily mean to say it actually is, but Eastern Europe as a category has these attributes, and it kind of shifts around, right? Does that speak to your question?
Yeah, I'm curious sort of almost, I mean, it's not a statistical question, right? But so you can't be trafficked if you could move legally across borders otherwise, right? Is this where we kind of end up, that is in a way, once the border has been open, once it sort of flow, you're able to participate in that wonderful free-flowing of
right.
Europe, you're no longer kind of trafficable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you're no longer, you can't be intimidated, right, in a situation of employment abroad because you have a right to it, right? So, so you're not trafficable. What's that? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yes,
I'm kind of hoping that maybe my question will provoke Paul enough that he'll take it over and ask it better than me. But I kept hearing in your talk echoes of Agamben, the Arendt Agamben lineage. Yes. Along these lines, how can we speak about the sovereignty of the body in a culture that still cannot necessarily uniformly in Europe and the United States recognize the sovereignty of the body? With respect to issues like abortion or suicide or sex change, we already don't have any sovereignty of the body. And in that context, how can we even speak of sex slavery or slavery of the body? And it seems to me that where Agamben comes in and Arendt has to do with the assertion that human rights as such don't really exist, have never existed, that they are, in a sense, a caprice of the nation state. And as the nation state has deteriorated and failed to defend its own sovereignty, so the notion of human rights itself has deteriorated. So you have it pulling at both ends. Human rights is under attack because of increasing globalization and therefore increasing migrants, increasing border crossing, increased lack of clarity about where we belong and who can defend us. So globalization on the one hand, and on the other hand, the transformation of Europe itself from distinct nation states, each with its own language, as Lynchley would like to call it, to a kind of confederation or consortium in which the nation state status is eroded, and with that erosion, an even further erosion of the notion of human rights. And so, you know, how can, who's to say that these women, you know, who's to defend these women? You know, the whole thing pulls apart in so many different ways. One can speak all one wants about how they shouldn't be trafficked, it's a terrible thing. But it seems to me that civil rights, human rights itself is coming unstitched, radically becoming unstitched in our very recent lifetime, like in the past 2 or 3 years. And Agamben is, it seems to me, I speak as somebody who's not well schooled in Agamben, but he has his finger precisely on that notion that what if we took the risk of saying human rights don't exist? They never existed before. This is like thing, like God or whatever we thought existed, it turned out to be wrong. And now it's becoming increasingly clear to us that it was an hallucination, that category was an hallucination. Is that too grim? It's good that I have thunder and lightning.
Yeah.
I feel that I staged this.
But Paul is going to rephrase it.
There's an Agamben somewhere in what you're saying that I think would rise up and embrace this argument and strengthen it enormously. I just am not the person that can summon that Agamben.
I'm a bad person to allude to with Adamo because I'm not an admirer of Adamo. And the early Europe theoretical critique of rights that I think of all the time is actually Foucault's critique of rights, which is part of the critique of the state. So putting aside the question of bare life and all that sort of stuff, the problem of freedom or the problem of adjudication of power, the way in which you make, this is Foucault talking about, right? The way in which you make power reversible requires the suspension of the state, because the state is a device that prohibits the reversibility of power. So the appeal to rights, which is the just an appeal to the definitional power of the state, is inherently a contradiction in the Foucauldian apparatus about the problem of achieving reversibility of power. So the slave, this is one of the great Foucauldian thoughts that drives me crazy all the time, and I think it drives many people crazy. Foucault's mandatory definition, power is everywhere except in one place. It's the place where there are slaves. Where slavery appears, power disappears, because the very possibility of reversibility has been erased in slavery. In a curious way, that doesn't really seem to apply to what you're talking about, because your analytic of an epistemological material project has to do with the things that are given, as opposed to an analytic of the things that are given. So Foucault might say, so where there's the slave, there's no power, because the reversibility is preempted. Mm-hmm. You don't really care about that. What you really care about is the apparatus that surrounds and enables the way in which the notion of the sex slave comes into being, and that then becomes for you. And here's where I actually do have a question. That then becomes for you almost in the shadow of Daman, echoed through Gayatri. That becomes the opportunity for speculative analytic reading. Question I would then have would be the ethical question back to the Daimonian voice, which would say, what is the legitimate basis for making this complex that creates and encircles the slave, sex slave, etc., etc., with its inclusion and exclusion? What's the ethical basis upon which we carry out the literary deconstruction mm-hmm. in that space rather than Virgil gives us a chance to talk about ekphrasis without having to talk about anybody actually being tied to anything.
I think that...
I mean, just think of how any imprisoned person might say, why are you doing this to me? You know, you're adding to my encirclement. By the deconstruction of minds.
Right. There's a reason for this. I think it's because some of these questions came about when... Do you mind if I sit down?
Let me get you a chair. Why don't you come in the front, since there's so few?
There's lots of chairs. So some of these questions came about and I was... doing research on this at Pembroke and a few years ago now, and most people there were social scientists, everyone there was a social scientist, and so they would invoke their informants and their contacts and the way they tend to do it in a really transparent way without acknowledging necessarily or fully or not, their own framing or their own investment or engagement or desire, and in what they end up saying. And so my conflict with them actually was a little bit similar. Don't you have to deal with the real world? That's how they put it. What you talk about isn't real. And I think that the ethical basis is that these kinds of the debates or the conversations that these particular kinds of scholars, not the ones I was with there necessarily, but anthropologists and sociologists who work on trafficking, most of their work is trying to recuperate the agency of the trafficked person or the sex worker, which has a political agenda, an admirable political agenda of, you know, acknowledging sex work as such as a form of labor and then making it protectable by the state rather than subject to, you know, all kinds of harassment from police and etc. And so the way they would talk about it would be like, I went to this bar in the Philippines and talked to women there and they don't feel oppressed and they're not they're not trying to think of themselves as victims and therefore they're not victims. It was literally how the conversations were framed, even if the scholarly writing was a little more substantial than this. And and I felt like there was something at stake for them in being able to do this, in being able to claim agency, full agency and sovereignty, to use that word, for a situation that they really didn't necessarily have authority to do so. And that, so deconstruction intervenes by kind of putting side by side, which I didn't really do here in what I read, but putting side by side two apparently irreconcilable positions with respect to trafficking and sex work, one that is, completely immersed in the rhetoric of abolitionism, and the other side that is invested in recovering the agency of a sex worker. And these figures themselves, I mean, as I said earlier, the work itself and the representations are unstable, multiple, they are multiply figured, and there is no immediate kind of access to consciousness of a sex worker in the way that they represent it. And I think that, am I making sense? Or I don't mean to be too simplistic either, but the way that both of these apparently totally oppose ways of seeing the same phenomenon, right? They seem antagonistic to each other, but I think they are actually both invested in humanizing the sex worker through a kind of liberal idea of rights. The abolitionists depict the totally brutalized body that then becomes resurrected and restores to full humanity. But before that, we have to see it dehumanized. The other side says, what are you talking about? They're always already human. Look how fine they are, you know? And I think both work within a kind of liberal understanding, a liberal understanding of recognition as a basis of sovereignty that I think doesn't really account for the actual situation of sex work, because the question of consent can very well be there, but it's always under the shadow of compulsion and poverty, right? And necessity, even though there is such a thing as middle or upper class sex workers. So that's one kind of conclusion or making sense of things that I think deconstruction has led me towards, but I don't think that it's unethical.
I was not suggesting that.
No, I know.
I was saying that I was in a sense asking back to the upside down deconstructive question, which is to say, where is ethos in the act of deconstruction? Mm-hmm. I mean, what you just said is very clear. You think them on, you think the repeated demonstration of the literariness of those discourses that claim themselves not to be literary, mm-hmm. which is what you just spoke about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then that raises the place where he arrives late in his career about the ethical consequences of that act of deconstructive aestheticization. So I was simply saying back to you that it is conceivable that from within the, use of horrible phrase, the actual practice of sex slave life, sex work life, it is possible that a political question could be put back that says, on what is the ethos that performs its demonstration of the fictionality of anthropological discourse upon the brutal realities of trafficked women? Something like that could be said, to which, of course, the counter gestures would be fairly obvious. So that's all I was saying.
Right.
But I think what comes out over and over again, what you just said, at least to me, and I think of this in popular culture as well as in theory, is that it's all these discourses are not only very heavily sexed, gendered, right? I mean, it's always the man who's going to save the girl. Mm-hmm. You can see that in the popular culture of what is it, Taken, those Taken sequences, right? Mm-hmm. It's also very paternalistic. It's also very much to do with the idealized, the idealized ideals of North Atlantic culture, supposed dominant North Atlantic culture. If there's sex trafficking inside France or the United States, it has to do with corruption and crime, or maybe with Russian immigrants who were involved. All of that in play. But it's these externalizations of North Atlantic liberal, supposedly liberal culture, which in part has led to, among other things, Judy Butler and others, right? Charles Taylor's critique of the basis of that liberalism on the backs, as they say, of women in the third world, particularly Islamic women. And so they launch the post-secularist critique as if somehow that were not a European gesture. I mean, I think I'm just suggesting this is really interesting and entangled in so many problems.
Well, I think...
And if you could disentangle them in a minute or two.
I was going to say to the question of deconstruction also is that, or the kind of demand you're meeting, is that, and on the question of witnessing, that may be kind of outdated, but also is very much in circulation still, at least in human rights discourse, that in relying on the spectacular, always, and on kind of heightening the spectacle because of compassion fatigue, which is just a theory, right? But there's kind of a dead end. And the spectacular doesn't necessarily misrepresent or invent because, but there's a lot more, there are a lot of other things going on that are difficult, that become difficult to capture in an unspectacular narrative or image that have a different temporality, that don't have a temporality of a discernible event, but that are really extended in time and dispersed. And I think that kind of witnessing, right? What is witnessing? I don't know. That's what it's concerned with. How do you raise awareness? It's kind of an old question. How do you raise awareness and concern for things that are just kind of mundane and everyday, but still terrible? Oh, you wait for a significant event, right, of that terribleness, and then you get to talk about it, or report it, or organize around it. But the everyday isn't reportable. Does that make sense?
I think there's another dimension to it too. As you were talking, I was thinking that, there is this two-sided thing. One is the goods and services you want to extract from those people. Let's say you want to extract domestic labor from them, or you want to extract sex from them, or you want to extract sweatshop labor from them, or fishing, deep sea fishing. You put them in a trawler, take them out, they can't get away, and they have to work as. So there's the stuff you want to extract from them in a purely mercantile fashion. And the other dimension is the dimension of the hate crime, the animus towards this or that group. And I think that a clear discussion for me is befuddled by the fact, not in your presentation, but in the world, is befuddled by the fact that when one speaks of a hate crime, it's very clear if you talk about a hate crime, let's say against gay people, or against transgender people, or against African Americans, or against Jews. I get what that's about, more or less, even though there are instances there. But to speak of hate crimes against women, to actually enforce hate crimes against women, would bring the society to a standstill. Because in virtually any married household, I mean, in a sense, any intimate relationship, in Allegheny County alone, I mean, how would you prosecute hate crimes against women locally? You know? And I'm not saying that men are beasts and women are lovely. I'm just saying that the category of hate crime is a category that only seems to be invoked for certain classes of people and not for others, because the legal system would come to a halt.
It's not gendered.
Yeah, it's not gendered properly, you know? And so, therefore, to speak about sex slavery, you're dealing with this flickering image of, you know, are you extracting goods and services, which the rest of the society does quite properly, you know, you pay an X and they do Y, or are you dealing with a hate crime, which is a very fuzzy category that has to do with women, it seems to me. It's an almost unenforceable category, because there's so much hate crime against women. Who would bother to enforce it?
Remember Andrea Dworkin's famous, right, that's the famous argument that all heterosexual penetration
is rape.
Body is rape.
Yeah.
And so that ties to Katie McKinnon's attempt to write a countervailing statement, which is a highly state-functioning, legalistic account of the point at which we see this now in California, right? You can't say no, you have to say yes.
Yeah. It is rape and hate crime. Yeah, obviously.
Yeah,
we're never going to prosecute it as such.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that, well, I won't tell that joke. It's tasteless.
I think I'm going to. In light of the thundering outside, I think we should evacuate the building. Since when it falls, it would be very loud.
Yeah.
I just want to ask one quick question. When I was listening to your talk, I couldn't help but think of a story by Borges called Emma Zooms. I don't know if you know it. But it has to do with this woman who is trying to seek revenge for a crime against her father. And so she sells her body in order to be able to claim that the man who had attacked her father has raped her, a different man than the man that she sells her body to, but she wants to have evidence to show that she's been raped.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of the story, she comes to realize that this experience of selling her body is more horrible than she had anticipated that it would be. She thought she could just go through with it and, you know, have it interpreted later as a rape by the second man and so on. Anyway, it just occurred to me that maybe one of the things Borges was trying to do was to raise this issue of selling one's body and how horrible it should be understood. And I just wondered if you thought there was any connection at all between what he's doing in that story and some of the ideas that you were presenting in your paper, especially when you're talking about the literal act as opposed to the interpretation of the act and the way you present the act, because that's very much part of the story. What she actually goes through is selling her body, and then her efforts to have it reinterpreted as a rape by the
red,
state.
Red.
By the state.
I'm not sure if that's what you're asking, but the assumption
that... Well, just if there's any connection between the things that you're interested in and what Borges seems to be interested in.
I think the assumption that selling sex is somehow inherently, traumatizing or debasing or degrading, as opposed to other kinds of work, or as opposed to marriage, right? A number of us are married, I guess. But, there is a tradition in feminist thinking that thinks about marriage in terms of the contract, right, mm-hmm. that is really a version of, not a version of sex work in the sense that it's just as worthy of being stigmatized, but a version of sex work because it's another means for obtaining sustenance and care and livelihood,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that, especially the way that women used to be positioned, you know, in marriage was literally in that way, when, you know. So there's the other side of that, that the assumption that it is the most horrible thing one can do, and that one can have happened to one, is definitely there in this
mm-hmm.
dominant set of representations, but there's also a whole other tradition that tries to desensationalize it and make it more akin to other forms of reproductive labor.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.